It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new WisContext report looks at the Wisconsin lawyers who represent people facing deportation who are being detained here in the state. We'll find out about the challenges they face in representing their clients. First, it's time for a weekly look at the top stories in national politics. A recording of President Trump and his personal lawyer has been released, apparently talking about a payment to prevent a story from coming out before Election Day 2016. The White House is considering revoking security clearances for some former intelligence officials, and the White House says it's going to provide $12 billion in aid for farmers affected by retaliatory tariffs. And that's our question of the week for you. What do you think of the White House plan to give out this aid to farmers after other countries responded to steel and aluminum tariffs from the U.S.? If you're a farmer yourself, do you see this as a good move or the wrong answer? And if so, what would you like to see instead? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Huffington Post. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, yesterday, Amanda, this recording was released. It's then-candidate Donald Trump talking with his personal attorney, Michael Cohen, apparently about buying the silence of former model Karen McDougal, who alleged a year-long affair with Trump. The story was bought but not published by a media company owned by Trump's friend, David Pecker. Let's take a listen to what was released here.
I need to open up a company for the transfer of all of that info regarding our friend David, so that I'm going to do that right away. I've actually come up and I've spoken to Alan Weisselberg about how to set the whole thing up with funding. And it's all the stuff, because, you never know where that company, you never know where he's going to be. Correct. So I'm all over that. And I spoke to Alan about it when it comes time for the financing, which will be...
Listen, what financing?
We'll have to pay you. So
I'll pay the kid.
No.
Amanda, people are trying to break down what exactly was going on, some disputes over what exactly some of the audio meant. What are some of the main takeaways from the release of this audio?
So the main takeaway is that people in the White House have been lying for quite some time. I mean, I remember Hope Hicks, who obviously used to be a top communications aide to Trump, saying that we don't know anything about any payment. She said any claim of the affair was totally untrue. Her exact quote was, "We have no knowledge of any of this." I mean, that's obviously not true. I mean, maybe Hope Hicks didn't have knowledge of this, but Trump obviously did, because now he's caught on tape talking about this. And the other thing that struck me is that this doesn't sound like two men who are making a deal like this for the first time. They seem to be pretty familiar with what they're doing. Trump doesn't actually seem surprised by any of this, which obviously brings up the question of how many other deals they've done. And we obviously know about Stormy Daniels, that there was Michael Cohen supposedly paid her off to keep quiet about another affair with Donald Trump. Rudy Giuliani, Trump's lawyer, said that this would look good. This would be exculpatory for the president if it came out. But you can get into disagreements about whether Trump said pay her with a check or whether he's talked about cash. Regardless, I don't think it makes him look good.
Is there any thought that anything potentially illegal was involved here, though?
That's unclear. And I think that's where some of the questions about the financing and the structure are. Were they trying to hide the payments when they were sending them over to David Pecker, just months before the election? We don't really know, and some of the audio is spotty, but I don't know the legal ramifications for what this means for Trump.
And a big part of the story here is that tapes like this exist at all. Michael Cohen, as Trump's attorney, was taping some of these conversations, and now, willingly or unwillingly, as this case proceeds, they are being released here.
Right, and Trump's team is saying that's the real outrage, that Cohen recorded the conversations with Trump. And I don't think most people think that's the real outrage. Maybe Trump supporters find that to be the real outrage. But, once again, you have Trump in his own words caught on tape, which contradicts things he's been telling the public for quite some time. And I just, again, I don't think that looks good. It seems clear why he was so upset when authorities raided Michael Cohen's office, because Michael Cohen has Trump's secrets. And maybe he knew that Cohen was recording their conversations. Maybe he didn't. But I think Trump knows there's more out there.
We're talking about some of the top stories in national politics with Amanda Turkle from Huffington Post. Let's move on now. We've got this ongoing back and forth, Amanda, on tariffs with other countries, counter tariffs responding to our steel and aluminum tariffs. And now the White House saying, hey, we're going to use some of our executive authority to give $12 billion of relief to farmers who are affected by retaliatory tariffs. Do we know much in terms of details of how this would work?
Well, it would go to producers of soybeans, corn, wheat, cotton, dairy, hogs, and sorghum, who would be compensated according to the size of their harvest this year. The government would also purchase surplus products like beef, pork, and some other things that would be sent to food banks or through other government programs. I think that the problem here for a lot of people is that this is seen as temporary. This is $12 billion, which seems like a lot, but there are estimates that already corn, wheat, and soybean farmers, there was a study done, they've already lost more than $13 billion because of this trade war. The $12 billion may not be enough. And the question is, does the Trump administration really want to keep paying farmers just to continue these tariffs, which a lot of people see as political and sort of, red meat for his base. And many Republicans and Democrats are critical of this. And it's just, creating this massive government bailout for farmers because of Trump's tariff just strikes many people as not something they like seeing.
Yeah, Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson has been critical of the tariffs. And he said in response to this aid program, he was interviewed yesterday, he said, quoting here, "This is becoming more and more like a Soviet type of economy," end quote. And he said in a separate statement that farmers are looking for trade, not aid. So can you talk about the response from Republicans in particular who are not necessarily on board with this?
I mean, their response is a lot like what Senator Johnson is saying. If you pay farmers, they're arguing, to alleviate some of the pain in the short term, what farmers are saying is like, look, these contracts took us years to get. And so the trade war that you're starting, the aid isn't going to make up for it because we're not going to be able to get those contracts back. This is really hurting us in the long term. And a lot of Republicans are just, as Senator Johnson alluded to pretty bluntly, actually, they're not comfortable with creating a massive government program and another bailout. I don't know if it's really a Soviet program, but it is something that usually conservatives don't want to see.
We invited our callers to weigh in on this aid to farmers affected by retaliatory tariffs at 800-642-1234. Aaron is on the line in Peshtigo. Aaron, hi.
Hey, good afternoon.
What do you think?
I'm a farmer in Peshtigo, and I think these tariffs were completely short-sighted and ill thought out from the get-go. Whenever there's any sort of trade or policy dispute of any sort, farmers are usually the ones that end up footing the bill for it. These markets took years to produce. I'm a grass-fed beef producer. It's only been 2 years since we've been able to export beef to China, and now those markets are being cut off. That $12 billion is just a drop in the bucket for the damage that this is being caused. I got a neighbor that has lost $60,000 on soybeans sitting in his grain bins in the last 2 months because of the price drops and these tariffs. If the government really wants to help farmers, they need to work on opening up more markets, supporting small farmers by breaking up agribusiness conglomerates and putting more money towards ag research.
Aaron, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Taylor with us in Rushford, Minnesota. Taylor, hi.
Hey. This bailout subsidies or whatever you want to call it is just like any other farm program where any money that's in the pot is going to go to the largest corporate ag industry, farmers, whatever you want to call them, you can think of. The small guy, they're not going to get nothing. The way ag is going today, they want you to either get big or get out.
Taylor, are you a farmer yourself?
Yes, we have organic dairy along with beef and ewes, sheep.
Taylor, thanks a lot for calling in. And Amanda, politically, and we saw in Wisconsin and some other places, some rural counties were some of the places where you saw the biggest swings from Obama voters to Trump voters. Does that, you think, factor into the decision on this $12 billion of aid?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Trump announced it right before he's scheduled to visit Iowa, which is the nation's top soybean producer. I mean, Trump recognizes that he can't lose the votes of farmers. I mean, as your callers made clear, this aid might be not enough to fix that damage. But, I mean, there are other industries affected here besides farming. You know, Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska has said that it's great that you're providing temporary relief for farmers, but what about manufacturing industries and the energy industries who are also affected by this? Trump may not see them as politically valuable, so they're not getting immediate help. And I think that's why this troubles a lot of lawmakers, too, that this is just not a long-term, well-thought-out solution. This is something to help a group of politically valuable voters, basically.
Talking to Amanda Turkel, Washington Bureau Chief at the Huffington Post, about the top national news stories of the week. You can still weigh in on our question of the week at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of $12 billion of aid to farmers affected by retaliatory tariffs? By the way, we'll talk about this more tomorrow after 4:30. And Senator Ron Johnson will be on the morning show. I believe it's at about 7:40 tomorrow morning, talking about these issues as well. We continue our conversation with Amanda Turkel of the Huffington Post about the top political stories of the week in national politics. Take another caller on our question of the week about support for farmers affected by retaliatory tariffs. Bob is with us in Fond du Lac. Bob, hi.
Hey, how are you doing today? Nice talking to you.
Thanks.
This is a case of an excess of short-sightedness. The Argentinians have taken up the slack on U.S. soybean purchases from China. And the other problem that's become evident in the news is that the Chinese have moved into doing a lot of work in Africa on soybean planting. This has, and the Russians as well, in terms of soybean production. This has actually, in the long term, demoted the commodity use of America as a supplier of food to the world. One more step backwards. $12 billion, peanuts.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, as a candidate, Donald Trump definitely hit this trade issue. He was opposed to free trade agreements. He talked about tariffs on the campaign trail. Not a lot of support among Republicans in Congress, as we were talking about. Are there any efforts in Congress to step in on these tariffs?
I don't know how much we'll see on this. We hear Congress talk a lot about doing things, and we don't see much. They have talked about trying to blunt these, but again, so far we haven't really seen anything. The problem for Republicans is, although many of them disagree with these tariffs, and many of their constituents, I mean, we're hearing on the phone, many farmers are upset with these. The president is incredibly popular right now. He has sky-high approval ratings with his base, and it's higher than what many Republicans in Congress have. So they're afraid to cross him on any issue. I mean, the most criticism we've seen of him was his press conference with Vladimir Putin, and that was actually also incredibly popular with the Republican base. So Republicans so far just not willing to go against him that much.
Thanks to our callers on that topic. We'll have more on the subject of trade and support for trade tomorrow morning after 7 on the morning show, tomorrow at 4:30 here on Central Time. Let's move on to another issue. Amanda, you recently wrote about how Democrats in the U.S. Senate are approaching President Trump's Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. There's not really a lot in their toolkit to do to stop this, right?
No, they definitely don't have a lot. I mean, I have heard people say that Democrats should just shut down the Senate. They shouldn't show up for work. They should deny a quorum so that the Senate can't do any of its business. But none of those solutions will really work. Democrats are in the minority, and so there's just not much they can do. So they're focusing on messaging, and particularly their strategy is they need to keep their entire caucus together in voting against Brett Kavanaugh. and they are trying to win over one Republican senator to vote against him. And they, the two targets are Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Both tend to be more moderate Republicans, and they have expressed support for abortion and funding Planned Parenthood. And so Democrats are really hammering that Brett Kavanaugh could overturn Obamacare, and he could overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark abortion ruling. And so that's where Democrats are focusing their efforts.
And Amanda, you said all Democrats are would need to stay together to stop this, and they need to get a Republican to cross the aisle. Neither side of that equation is a sure thing, right?
No, definitely not. I mean, there were three Democrats, Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, and Joe Donnelly from Indiana, who crossed the aisle and voted for Neil Gorsuch, Trump's first Supreme Court pick. I think that the calculation may be a little bit different for those red state senators this time around because, you know, this Neil Gorsuch was replacing Antonin Scalia, another conservative, but this Supreme Court pick would be replacing Anthony Kennedy, who tends to be more moderate. And the fact that Brett Kavanaugh is known as a really strong conservative and not a moderate might give Democrats and perhaps some Republicans pause.
What are the key issues that Democrats are going to focus on? You mentioned abortion access and Roe versus Wade as one of them. Are there other things we might be seeing ads for, especially in states with a Senate election coming up?
Those are the big ones. But the other ones you might see a little bit on is this issue of executive power and Russia and Trump being, you know, the special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Brett Kavanaugh is known as a big defender of executive power, basically saying that the president has unlimited power to govern the executive branch as he so chooses. And then that just troubles a lot of Democrats who say that Trump is nominating him because if the special counsel on the Russia stuff ever reaches the Supreme Court, he'll let Trump off the hook. So there are some Democrats who are saying that Brett Kavanaugh should recuse himself from any issue that comes before the Supreme Court regarding the special counsel. I don't think you'll hear Brett Kavanaugh say that, but there are some Democrats who are bringing up this issue and are going to probably keep doing so.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from the Huffington Post about some of the top stories in national politics. Let's move on to this security clearance story. Amanda, the White House announced it was considering revoking the security clearances of some ex-government officials, intelligence officials in particular. Who are they looking at and why?
So they're looking at former CIA Director John Brennan, former FBI Director James Comey, and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper in particular. And this is just political. I mean, these are three people who have obviously been very critical of Donald Trump. And it's honestly pretty meaningless. These former heads of these intelligence agencies have sort of inactive security clearances. It's not like they're going into the FBI or to the CIA every day and reviewing top secret documents. It's more that if they are ever needed to do so, their security clearance can be reactivated quickly and then can go serve on a board, review documents, or do what they needed to do. So it's not really even just for the benefit of them. It's for the benefit of the government as well, who might need to call on the expertise of these former officials. Trump and the White House are saying that these former officials are somehow using their security access to make money to go on air and go on TV and criticize Trump. There's just no truth to that. It's just a purely political move of Trump trying to use his power to go after people who are criticizing him.
Now here's a listen to Press Secretary Sarah Sanders talking about the reasoning behind reconsidering the clearances.
Making baseless accusations of improper contact with Russia or being influenced by Russia against the president is extremely inappropriate. And the fact that people with security clearances are making these baseless charges provides inappropriate legitimacy to accusations with zero evidence.
So the idea that, okay, even if they're not using the security clearances, the fact that they have them gives legitimacy to statements they make in public in some way.
I mean, I think that's just silly. Honestly, no one is taking them seriously simply because they have a security clearance. I don't even know if many people know they still have a security clearance. People take them seriously because of the positions they've held and what they've done in the past. You know, they are these nonpartisan officials who have run the these intelligence agencies. I don't think it's because simply they have security clearances. So if you took away their security clearances, I think people would still be listening to them. They'd still be able to make the same criticisms, and they'd still have the same legitimacy.
And finally, a quick note on immigration. There's talk of an immigration vote that had been promised earlier being delayed again or not held at all. What's going on?
Sort of the same thing that always goes on with Congress. I mean, nothing happens on immigration, even though that there are, you know, Democrats want to do something. And there are many Republicans in the House who want to do something as well. Many of these Republicans are in races that are a little bit tighter, and many of their constituents want to see something done on immigration. And so there were some Republicans who received a promise from leadership to have a vote on an immigration bill. And Republicans are now saying, the Republican leadership is now saying they're not going to do it. And it seems to be that House Speaker Paul Ryan wants to avoid voting on a bill that seems like it will fail. Even though these Republicans say that was never the deal, they were always promised a vote, and it was unconditional whether or not the bill would pass. And so it's just, once again, Congress kicking the can down the road on immigration and nothing really happening.
We'll leave it there for now. Amanda, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Amanda Turkle is the Washington Bureau Chief for The Huffington Post. She was getting us caught up on some of the week's top stories in national politics. Two Wisconsin jails have contracts with the federal government to house people who are on immigration holds and face possible deportation. Legal representation is not guaranteed by law, so not all of those detainees have a lawyer. But even for those who are able to get legal assistance, it's not always an easy process for them or their attorneys. Scott Gordon is the associate editor of wiscontext.org. He looked into who's representing those on immigration holds in Wisconsin and what some of the challenges are. You can find his article at wiscontext.org. Scott, good to have you back with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we've talked about this a little before, but let's start out by looking at where in Wisconsin people are being held as they face possible deportation.
Right. So the two main places, at least, that kind of have a formal contract with the government and have sort of a, you know, a routine system for holding immigration detainees are in Kenosha and in Dodge County, and those are run by their respective county sheriff offices, basically. So they hold a mix of local detainees and people who are being held on behalf of ICE or another federal agency.
And as people are being held, they're going through this legal process, right? And as I understand from your piece, they would be appearing in court in Chicago. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So Wisconsin is under the jurisdiction of the Chicago Federal Immigration Court.
Now, people thinking of a criminal trial that might apply to a citizen in the United States, they think, okay, if you're making your case in court, you either are paying for your own defense attorney. If you can't, as they say, a lawyer will be provided for you. It's different for these immigration cases, right? Why? Why is that?
Well, it's a difficult thing to look at because it's these are technically civil cases. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe a lot of people don't know that, especially because they're treated so much like criminal cases. You know, at the government's discretion, someone can be detained throughout the whole process. But because they are technically civil cases and not criminal cases, the Supreme Court decision that gave people the right to a government-funded attorney in criminal courts, Gideon v. Wainwright, just doesn't apply. So they have a right to have an attorney in this situation, but they don't have a right to have the government pay for it.
So does it end up happening that some of these people who are challenging their deportation are representing themselves?
Yes, especially most of the people who are detained, people who aren't detained through the process have statistically fared a bit better in terms of the representation they get and the outcomes they get.
Right. So if you are an immigrant, say a Spanish-speaking person trying to represent yourself, that's going to be a tall order in a courtroom, it sounds like.
Right. If you can't afford a lawyer or get a nonprofit to, you know, to take on your case or get an attorney to take on your case basically at a loss or, you know, get friends and family to pull together some money to hire an attorney, then, yeah, you are representing yourself in federal government and it's you against federal immigration judges and attorneys trying to make your case. And you know, someone who hasn't had access to an attorney or is going dealing with this process for the first time or doesn't speak English very well, you know, might have a hard time, understandably, navigating that and knowing and asserting their rights and, you know, dealing with the process.
And if someone's trying to pay for an attorney out of their pocket, A, these might be people with not a lot of resources. B, as you write this, it sounds really time consuming for the attorneys working with people who are being detained, having to go to Chicago for a day to deal with 5 minutes of courtroom time.
Right. And I mean, obviously, it's no secret in any context that lawyering, representing someone's case is a lot of work. But say you're an attorney in Milwaukee or Madison, you're going to be driving around a lot to get to immigration court in Chicago, to get to also whichever facility the person is being held in, which could be in Kenosha or Dodge County, or could be somewhere else around the Midwest, or they could also get moved around the country, which is a whole other issue. But yeah, it is a great deal of work for these folks, and it's expensive. And especially if you're an attorney in private practice, there's no getting around the fact that you have to make money somehow to keep the lights on. So it does put some of these attorneys in kind of a tough position.
You mentioned nonprofit options. What kind of nonprofit, or I guess they call it pro bono legal representation? Is there much out there in Wisconsin for people being detained here?
Well, if you put together the sort of nonprofit law centers that focus on immigration specifically, you know, for instance, I spoke with an attorney for the Community Immigration Law Center based here in Madison. There are also folks out of the UW Law School who run an immigration law clinic that provides some free representation. And then put those together with attorneys who are just in private practice and, you know, take on some of these cases, often at a loss. You know, I've been told at least that there's maybe a dozen people who can really take on or willing to take on kind of the cases of detained people in these immigration hearings where, again, where the stakes are very high. You know, basically the government wants to deport them and they have to try to make some kind of case that they can be allowed to stay in the country, you know, as a recipient of asylum or, you know, under some other kind of condition.
Talking to Scott Gordon from wiscontext.org. He wrote a piece on legal representation for immigrants being detained in Wisconsin, facing potential deportation. All right, Scott, one of these detainees gets an attorney, whether they're paying for it or they're getting a nonprofit help. What kind of hurdles are there for access and contact between the attorney and their client in this kind of case?
Well, for anyone who's detained, there's rules about visiting hours and telephone access and things like that. Attorneys generally have a bit more leeway in when they can come visit somebody, you know, as opposed to someone's family or friends trying to visit them in a jail. So that can make it difficult. And as I hinted at before, someone who's detained in federal custody, ICE can just kind of move them around at their discretion. And sometimes there are good reasons for doing that. Sometimes someone has, you know, a visit scheduled at the consulate of their country of origin and obviously has to go somewhere else if there's not a consulate nearby. But there are, you know, some well-documented cases and patterns of people being kind of shuffled around the country, what looks like rather capriciously. So obviously, if you're trying to keep in touch with the client and they might be getting moved around on short notice, that obviously makes that all the more difficult. And of course, makes it all, I mean, not to belittle what the actual person in detention is going through, makes it harder on them.
You asked some of the defense attorneys about how cooperative these Wisconsin facilities were in giving them access. What kind of answers did you get?
Well, just about everyone I talked to has said more or less the same thing, which is that they actually have decent working relationships with the people who run the jails. And again, in the case of the Dodge and Kenosha facilities, these are run by the county governments. They're not operated by the federal government. The federal government gives them, the counties, millions of dollars every year to you know, to hold these federal detainees. But their gripe is more of a bigger systemic thing. And they're saying, why should we be detaining people at all in what's a civil proceeding, especially if they're people who don't pose a flight risk or don't pose a threat to the community? And, you know, why are we allowing them to go through something that, you know, places extra trauma on people who, in many cases, have already been traumatized, dealt with violence, dealt with poverty, you know, dealt with the things that, that they're trying to find some kind of refuge from.
As we wrap up, Scott, did you get a sense from the defense attorneys who do work with people facing deportation that there's not enough of them, the attorneys, to go around for the cases that, that need representation?
Yes, I did. And that's absolutely true if you look at the numbers of, you know, just how few, especially detained people in immigration removal proceedings, go through it without representation. And it's, you know, been shown in various studies, which have mostly been admittedly kind of localized to different courts, that someone without representation in these proceedings is way more likely to get deported and way less likely to, you know, find some kind of relief.
We'll leave it there for now. Scott, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Scott Gordon is the associate editor of WisContext.org. He talked to lawyers who represent people held on immigration charges here in Wisconsin. You can find his article at WisContext.org. The team of scientists from Harvard University recently announced that they've developed technology to remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and convert it into liquid fuel. They expect to be able to do this at industrial levels by the year 2021. The hope is that the technology could be used to cut CO2 levels in the atmosphere and limit the impact of climate change, but that could be a long way off. Robinson Meyer is a staff writer covering climate change and technology at The Atlantic. Robinson, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, absolutely. Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, spell out the basic idea from this paper. What are we doing with air to turn it into fuel?
Well, it's a bit complicated, but it is fairly easy to explain because it takes three. What we're doing is we're taking three industrial processes which exist elsewhere in industry, elsewhere in factories across the world, and we're bringing them together. And so, if you think about it, so there's CO2 in air, and although CO2 is really powerful at a global level, there's just not much of it in any kind of one cubic foot of air, let's say. When we talk about CO2, we're talking about 400 parts per million. That means you have to get a million molecules of air, right, to start getting into the hundreds of CO2 molecules. And what you really care about is sieving out the hundreds of CO2 molecules. So we subjected to three processes. The first is that it kind of gets sucked into cooling towers. So if you can think of like a giant nuclear cooling tower in reverse, what a cooling tower does is it exposes as much liquid to air as possible in order to cool down the liquid. In this case, what we care about is exposing the air to the liquid, and there's a certain chemical in that exposure process that's really basic and bonds with the slightly acidic CO2 in the air. Then it's brought into the factory, and it undergoes a series of kind of chemical reactions that includes freezing it into pellets and heating it up to take the CO2 out of the carbonate solution that was formed in the cooling tower. That's something we already do all around the world in paper mills, like taking CO2 out of a carbonate solution. It's just a very kind of common industrial process. And then at that point, we have concentrated CO2 gas. So at this point, we've separated the CO2 out of the air. We have it in a concentrated form. And you can do two things with it then. You could bury it in the ground. And at that point, you know, we're literally taking CO2 out of the air. That's how you would start to reverse geoengineer global warming. And the other thing that this team is looking at doing right now is it's subjected to what's called a Fischer-Tropsch process, which is where you convert a hydrocarbon gas like CO2 into gasoline or diesel or jet fuel. You basically convert. Normally, a Fischer-Tropsch process is used to convert natural gas into gasoline or diesel or some kind of liquid fuel that can be easily exported and burned.
Yeah, if I have this carbon I've captured out of the air and I want to sequester it, I want to bury it in the ground, great, but the downside is nobody's really going to pay me to do that. So this idea, the quest here is, can we get some use out of it again? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. So I should probably back up and say that there's two companies that are looking at doing this. One is called Carbon Engineering. It's based in the U.S. and Canada. And the other is called Climeworks, and it's based in Switzerland. And right now, they both are working on variations of this process. And exactly as you said, what we would kind of love to do as a species is eventually just put the CO2 back into the ground, you know, in this, maybe in the same places where we drilled it out for oil reserves in the first place, and, you know, just keep it there forever, and that's how we'll solve global warming, and or that's one way to solve global warming, right? The problem is that there's no one to pay for that, exactly. You need a government to pay for it. It doesn't generate a profit. And so the idea right now is that as this process continues to get cheaper, and as we wait for governments to maybe be willing to subsidize a reverse geoengineering planet Earth, we could turn that CO2 back into gasoline or some kind of fossil fuel that then could be sold on the market. And though that gasoline would eventually emit all that CO2 back into the air, it would be a carbon neutral process because we wouldn't be digging CO2 out of the ground and then adding it to the air. We'd be pulling it out of the air and making gas and then adding it back into the air. So it wouldn't increase global carbon levels.
And you mentioned the cost of actually doing this. It seems like if money were no object, we could do this. But the one of the papers you wrote about and that North American company, they did this and they said, hey, this is in a range of cost that this might be doable and expandable and scalable, right?
That's right. So it used to be that this kind of geoengineering was just considered way too costly to ever be plausible. There was a report in 2012 that said it was going to be at least $700, $800, $900 to pull out a ton of CO2, which is tends to be the units that we talk about. This team, the carbon engineering team, which is based in U.S. and Canada and led by this Harvard scientist, David Keith, says they can do it for between $100 to $250. So that's a huge decrease in costs over the past 7 years. It mostly comes from taking these industrial processes elsewhere and adapting them to this technique. I would say that even though it's still really cheap compared to what we think it used to cost, it's would become a huge outlay were the government to decide it just wanted to start pumping carbon out of the air. So, for instance, you know, in 2018, the U.S. emitted about 6.8 billion tons of CO2 into the atmosphere. Even at the cheapest cost estimate, right, that's $687 billion to pull it all back out. And that's a budget that, while smaller than the federal government budget, is much larger than the Department of Defense's budget. So it's a lot of money, even though it's much cheaper now than we ever thought it would be able to be.
Talking to Robinson Meyer from The Atlantic about a new technology that is at least pointing toward the promise of pulling CO2 out of the air, fighting global warming, and then turning it into gas that you can sell back to people to use. Robinson, in the piece you wrote about this, you talked to some outside experts, people who are not directly involved with the project. Were they excited, hopeful, skeptical? What kind of things did you hear?
They were excited. You know, it's funny because this is exactly the kind of project that you talk to outside experts to shoot down. You know, normally when you this kind of big geoengineering scheme to fix global warming, this is something that outside experts, that most serious climate scientists, I think, believe in most forms to be unlikely. And yet when you talk to people who have been studying these issues for a while and thinking about these kinds of topics, what they all said was, hey, you know, this, looking at the paper, this is very plausible. Yeah.
And now the head of carbon engineering, that professor you mentioned, he's saying, it sounds like, hey, we still need to cut back on our CO2 emissions, right? He's saying, don't wait for this stuff to come along and save us.
Yeah, this is, and I think this is probably the most controversial part of this research, is that it's very easy to hear about this research and say, oh, this is amazing. We're just going to pull CO2 out of the air. It's going to be super cheap. And none of us ever have to, you know, make the kind of changes to our life right now, or at least we don't have to pass the kind of policies that would truly fix global warming on the kind of national or international level. You know, I think he'd say there's two things there. First of all, right now, just pulling out CO2 is really, really expensive. We still couldn't afford to do it, and there's a lot of ways to reduce emissions that are way cheaper. In terms of preventing a ton of CO2 from entering the atmosphere, then this technique would pull it out of the atmosphere. So there are lots of things you can do that are cheaper than $100 that prevent a ton of CO2 from going into the atmosphere. The second thing is that already right now, the UN thinks we're going to have to pull some CO2 out of the atmosphere in order to just keep the Earth from warming by more than 2 degrees Celsius. So in some ways, we have to do everything we can, including develop this geoengineering technique and reduce our CO2 emissions in normal ways, just to kind of keep the Earth within a healthy and safe envelope in the next century or two.
Right, because even if this technology is put in at such a large scale and met all of our fuel needs, all that's doing is keeping things steady. It's not taking any carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, and there are other things inputting it in. So this alone doesn't save us.
Yes, this alone doesn't save us, and especially if we just use this technology to just serve our fuel needs, then we won't be affecting the amount of carbon in the atmosphere at all, and the Earth will continue to warm. What we would have to do is start using it to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere and stick it in the ground somewhere, and that is how we would start to bring down CO2 levels worldwide. The other thing I'd note, by the way, is just that it's going to take a long time for this kind of gas, for this CO2 neutral gas or diesel or jet fuel that produced by this technique, to be price competitive with regular gas that we've drilled out of the ground. And the fastest way to get it there would be to pass some kind of economy-wide carbon tax or carbon price, which would immediately make normal gas much more expensive and this kind of gas much cheaper. Or even if there were other kinds of smaller policies that just affected gas prices on a smaller level or subsidized this kind of gas, the only way that it's going to become price competitive and that we're going to see kind of economy-wide or even smaller region-wide transitions, sector-wide transitions to this CO2 neutral gas is with some kind of climate policy.
We'll leave it there for now. Robertson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much.
That was Robertson Meyer, staff writer at The Atlantic. We've been learning about new technology aimed at removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, then converting it into liquid fuel. Between now and the August 14th primary, Wisconsin Public Radio has invited candidates who are running in contested primaries for statewide office and congressional seats to join us for interviews here on Central Time and on The Morning Show. We'll start our version of those out today in just a few minutes, and you can check out all these interviews at wisconsinvote.org. Back on Monday, we talked about the Wisconsin Monarch Collective. That's not, by the way, an effort to turn Wisconsin into a monarchy, but a collaboration to build more habitat for the monarch butterfly and help restore the monarch population in Wisconsin and around the eastern half of the United States. DNR expert Owen Boyle told us that they're looking for help from farmers, homeowners, street maintenance departments, utility companies, and more. What kind of help? Plant some milkweed.
We've figured out that we need about 120 million additional stems of milkweed in the state of Wisconsin by 2038.
And it looks like WPR listeners are helping reach that goal. We posted an article on the Ideas Network Facebook page, and a lot of you responded with comments and pictures of your own milkweed plants, some of them with monarch butterflies hanging around. Terry writes, "We have plenty of milkweed. Would like to see more monarchs, though." Rick says, "My wife has some in her butterfly garden. It's like a regular garden, but with all plants that attract butterflies." John tells us, "We Middleton Glen residents have protected the milkweed in our nature growing area, and we've seen many monarchs. They also like our coneflowers." And Joan says, "You don't have to plant it, just let it grow." And that's been my strategy in my backyard. Just leave it alone, and it's doing fine. Haven't seen any monarchs back there quite yet. Let us know if you have milkweed in your yard and send a picture on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.